Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 16th through the 26th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your bedroom, living room, or home office, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Section 3 of The Marico Deep by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Thomas Copeland. 3. When I came to myself, I could not at first imagine where I was. The events of the previous day were like some blurred nightmare, and I could not believe that I had to accept them as facts. I looked round in bewilderment at the large, bare, windowless room with drab-coloured walls, at the lines of quivering purplish light which flowed along the cornices, at the scattered articles of furniture, and finally at the two other beds, from one of which came the high-pitched, strident snore which I had learned aboard the Stratford to associate with Marico. It was too grotesque to be true, and it was only when I fingered my bed-cover and observed the curious woven material and dried fibres of some sea-plant from which it was made that I was able to realize this inconceivable adventure which had befallen us. I was still pondering it when there came a loud explosion of laughter, and Bill Scanlon sat up in bed. "Mornin', Beau!" he cried, amid his chuckles on seeing that I was awake. "You seem to be in good spirits," said I, rather testily. "I can't see that we have much to laugh about." "Well, I had a grouch on me the same as you when first I woke up," he answered. "Then came a real cute idea, and it was that made me laugh." "I could do with a laugh myself," said I. "What's the idea?" "Well, Beau, I thought how derned funny it would have been if we had all tied ourselves on to that deep-sea line. I allow, with those glass Ginguses, we could have kept breathing all right. Then, when old man Howie looked over the side, there would have been the whole bunch of us coming up at him through the water. He would have figured that he had hooked us, sure. Gee, what a spiel!" Our united laughter woke the doctor, who sat up in bed with the same amazed expression upon his face which had previously been on my own. I forgot our troubles as I listened in amusement to his disjointed comments, which alternated between ecstatic joy at the prospect of such a field of study and profound sorrow that he could never hope to convey his results to his scientific confrère of the earth. Finally, he got back to the actual needs of the moment. "It is 9 o'clock, he said, looking at his watch. "We all registered the same hour, but there was nothing to show if it was night or morning." "We must keep our own calendar," said Marico. "We descended upon October 3rd. We reached this place on the evening of the same day. How long have we slept?" "My gosh, it may have been a month," said Scanlon. "I've not been so deep since Mickey Scott got me on the point in the 6-round tryout at the works." We dressed and washed, for every civilized convenience was at hand. The door, however, was fastened, and it was clear that we were prisoners for the time. In spite of the apparent absence of any ventilation, the atmosphere kept perfectly sweet, and we found that this was due to a current of air which came through small holes in the wall. There was some source of central heating, too, for, though no stove was visible, the temperature was pleasantly warm. Presently I observed a knob upon one of the walls, and pressed it. This was, as I expected, a bell, for the door instantly opened, and a small, dark man, dressed in a yellow robe, appeared in the aperture. He looked at us inquiringly, with large brown, kindly eyes. "We are hungry," said Marico. "Can you get us some food?" The man shook his head and smiled. It was clear that the words were incomprehensible to him. Scanlon tried his luck with a flow of American slang, which was received with the same blank smile. When, however, I opened my mouth and thrust my finger into it, our visitor nodded vigorously and hurried away. 10 minutes later the door opened, and two of the yellow attendants appeared, rolling a small table before them. Had we been at the Biltmore Hotel, we could not have had better fare. There were coffee, hot milk, rolls, delicious flat fish, and honey. For half an hour we were far too busy to discuss what we ate or whence it was obtained. At the end of that time the two servants appeared once more, rolled out the tray, and closed the door carefully behind them. "I'm fair black and blue with pinching myself," said Scanlon. "Is this a pipe dream or what? Say, Doc, you got us down here, and I guess it is up to you to tell us just how you size it all up." The doctor shook his head. "It is like a dream to me also, but it is a glorious dream. What a story for the world, if we could but get it to them!" "One thing is clear," said I. "There was certainly truth in this legend of Atlantis, and some of the folk have in a marvellous way managed to carry on." "Well, even if they carried on," cried Bill Scanlon, scratching his bullet head, "I am darned if I can understand how they could get air and fresh water and the rest. Maybe if that queer duck with the beard that I saw last night comes to give us a once-over, he will put us wise to it." "How can he do that when we have no common language?" "Well, we shall use our own observation," said Marico. "One thing I can already understand. I learned it from the honey at breakfast. That was clearly synthetic honey, such as we have already learned to make upon the earth. But if synthetic honey, why not synthetic coffee or flour? The molecules of the elements are like bricks, and these bricks lie all around us. We have only to learn how to pull out certain bricks, sometimes just a single brick, in order to make a fresh substance. Sugar becomes starch, or ether becomes alcohol, just by a shifting of the bricks. What is it that shifts them? Heat, electricity, other things, perhaps, of which we know nothing. Some of them will shift themselves, and radium becomes lead, or uranium becomes radium without our touching them. You think, then, that they have an advanced chemistry? I'm sure of it. After all, there is no elemental brick which is not ready to their hands. Hydrogen and oxygen come readily from the seawater. There are nitrogen and carbon in those masses of sea vegetation, and there are phosphorus and calcium in the bathypic deposit. With skillful management and adequate knowledge, what is there which could not be produced?" The doctor had launched upon a chemical lecture when the door opened and Manda entered, giving us a friendly greeting. There came with him the same old gentleman of venerable appearance whom we had met the night before. He may have had a reputation for learning, for he tried several sentences, which were probably different languages, upon us, but all were equally unintelligible. Then he shrugged his shoulders and spoke to Manda, who gave an order to the two yellow-clad servants still waiting at the door. They vanished, but returned presently with a curious screen supported by two side-posts. It was exactly like one of our cinema screens, but it was coated with some sparkling material which glittered and shimmered in the light. This was placed against one of the walls. The old man then paced out very carefully a certain distance and marked it upon the floor. Standing at this point, he turned to Marico and touched his forehead, pointing to the screen.
"Clean dippy," said Scanlon. "Bats in the belfry."
Marico shook his head to show that we were nonplussed. So was the old man for a moment. An idea struck him, however, and he pointed to his own figure. Then he turned towards the screen, fixed his eyes upon it, and seemed to concentrate his attention. In an instant a reflection of himself appeared on the screen before us. Then he pointed to us, and a moment later our own little group took the place of his image. It was not particularly like us. Scanlon looked like a comic Chinaman, and Marico like a decayed corpse, but it was clearly meant to be ourselves as we appeared in the eyes of the operator. "It's a reflection of thought," I cried. "Exactly," said Marico. "This is certainly a most marvelous invention, and yet it is but a combination of such telepathy and television as we dimly comprehend upon Earth." I never thought I'd live to see myself in the movies, if that cheese-faced chink is really meant for me," said Scanlon. "Say, if we could get all this news to the editor of the Ledger, he'd cough up enough to keep me for life. We've sure got the goods if we could deliver them." "That's the trouble," said I. "By George, we could stir the whole world if we could only get back to it. But what is he beckoning about?" "The old guy wants you to try your hand at it, Doc." Maricot took the place indicated, and his strong, clear-cut brain focused his picture to perfection. We saw an image of Manda, and then another one of the Stratford as we had left her. Both Manda and the old scientist nodded their great approval at the sight of the ship, and Manda made a sweeping gesture with his hands, pointing first to us and then to the screen. "To tell them all about it, that's the idea," I cried. "They want to know in pictures who we are and how we got here." Maricot nodded to Manda to show that he understood, and had begun to throw an image of our voyage when Manda held up his hand and stopped him. At an order, the attendants removed the screen, and the two Atlanteans beckoned that we should follow them. It was a huge building, and we proceeded down corridor after corridor until we came at last to a large hall with seats arranged in tiers like a lecture room. At one side was a broad screen of the same nature as that which we had seen. Facing it was assembled an audience of at least 1,000 people, who set up a murmur of welcome as we entered. They were of both sexes and of all ages, the men dark and bearded, the women beautiful in youth and dignified in age. We had little time to observe them, for we were led to seats in the front row, and Maricot was then placed on a stand opposite the screen. The lights were in some fashion turned down, and he had the signal to begin. And excellently well he played his part. We first saw our vessel sailing forth from the Thames, and a buzz of excitement went up from the tense audience at this authentic glimpse of a real modern city. Then a map appeared, which marked her course. Then was seen the steel shell with its fittings, which was greeted with a murmur of recognition. We saw ourselves once more descending and reaching the edge of the abyss. Then came the appearance of the monster who had wrecked us. "Marax! Marax!" cried the people as the beast appeared. It was clear that they had learned to know and to fear it. There was a terrified hush as the creature fumbled with our hawser, and a groan of horror as the wires parted and we dropped into the gulf. In a month of explanation, we could not have made our plight so clear as in that half-hour of visible demonstration. As the audience broke up, they showered every sign of sympathy upon us, crowding round us and patting our backs to show that we were welcome. We were presented in turn to some of the chiefs, but the chieftainship seemed to lie in wisdom alone, for all appeared to be on the same social scale and were dressed in much the same way. The men wore tunics of a saffron color coming down to the knees, with belts and high boots of a scaly, tough material, which must have been the hide of some sea beast. The women were beautifully draped in classical style, their flowing robes of every tint of pink and blue and green, ornamented with clusters of pearl or opalescent sheets of shell. Many of them were lovely beyond any earthly comparison. There was one, but why should I mix my private feelings up with this public narrative? Let me say only that Mona is the only daughter of Scarpa, one of the leaders of the people, and that from that first day of meeting I read in her dark eyes a message of sympathy and of understanding which went home to my heart, as my gratitude and admiration may have gone to hers. I need not say more at present about this exquisite lady. Suffice it that a new and strong influence had come into my life. When I saw Maricot gesticulating with unwonted admiration to one kindly lady, while Scanlon stood conveying his admiration in pantomime in the center of a group of laughing girls, I realized that my companions also had begun to find that there was a lighter side to our tragic position. If we were dead to the world, we had at least found a life beyond, which promised some compensation for what we had lost. Later in the day, we were guided by Manda and other friends round some portions of the immense building. It had been so embedded in the seafloor by the accumulations of ages that it was only through the roof that it could be entered, and from this point the passages led down and down until the floor level was reached several hundred feet below the entrance chamber. The floor in turn had been excavated, and we saw in all directions passages which sloped downwards into the bowels of the earth. We were shown the air-making apparatus with the pumps which circulated it through the building. Marico pointed out with wonder and admiration that not only was the oxygen united with the nitrogen, but that smaller retorts supplied other gases which could only be the argon, neon, and other little-known constituents of the atmosphere which we are only just beginning to understand. The distilling vats for making fresh water and the enormous electrical installments were other objects of interest, but much of the machinery was so intricate that it was difficult for us to follow the details. I can only say that I saw with my own eyes and tested with my own palate that chemicals in gaseous and liquid forms were poured into various machines, that they were treated by heat, by pressure, and by electricity, and that flour, tea, coffee, or wine was collected as the product. There was one consideration which was very quickly forced upon us by our examination on various occasions of as much of this building as was open to our inspection. This was that the exposure to the sea had been foreseen, and the protection against the inrush of the water had been prepared long before the land sank beneath the waves. Of course, it stood to reason, and needed no proof, that such precautions could not have been taken after the event. But we were witnesses now of the signs that the whole great building had from the first been constructed with the one idea of being an enduring ark of refuge. The huge retorts and vats in which the air, the food, the distilled water, and the other necessary products were made were all built into the walls, and were evidently integral parts of the original construction. So, too, with the exit chambers, the silica works where the vitrine bells were constructed, and the huge pumps which controlled the water. Every one of these things had been prepared by the skill and the foresight of that wonderful faraway people who seemed, from what we could learn, to have thrown out one arm to Central America and one to Egypt, and so left traces of themselves even upon this earth when their own land went down into the Atlantic. As to these their descendants, we judged that they had probably degenerated, as was natural, and that at most they had been stagnant and only preserved some of the science and knowledge of their ancestors, without having the energy to add to it. They possessed wonderful powers, and yet seemed to us to be strangely wanting in initiative, and had added nothing to that wonderful legacy which they had inherited. I am sure that Marico, using this knowledge, would very soon have attained greater results. As to Scanlon, with his quick brain and mechanical skill, he was continually putting in touches which probably seemed as remarkable to them as their powers to us. He had a beloved mouth organ in his coat pocket when we made our descent, and his use of this was a perpetual joy to our companions, who sat around in entranced groups, as we might listen to a Mozart, while he handed out to them the crooning coon songs of his native land. I have said that the whole building was not open to our inspection, and I might give a little further detail upon that subject. There was one well-worn corridor down which we saw folk continually passing, but which was always avoided by our guides in our excursions. As was natural, our curiosity was aroused, and we determined one evening that we would take a chance and do a little exploring upon our own account. We slipped out of our room, therefore, and made our way to the unknown quarter at a time when few people were about. The passage led us to a high-arched door which appeared to be made of solid gold. When we pushed it open, we found ourselves in a huge room forming a square of not less than 200 feet. All around, the walls were painted with vivid colors and adorned with extraordinary pictures and statues of grotesque creatures with enormous headdresses, like the full-dress regalia of our American Indians. At the end of this great hall there was one huge seated figure, the legs crossed like a Buddha, but with none of the benignity of aspect which is seen on the Buddha's placid features. On the contrary, This was a creature of wrath, open-mouthed and fierce-eyed, the latter being red, and their effect exaggerated by two electric lights which shone through them. On his lap was a great oven, which we observed, as we approached it, to be filled with ashes.
Moloch, said Marco. Moloch or Baal, the old god of the Phoenician races.
Good heavens, I cried, with recollections of old Carthage before me. Don't tell me that these gentle folk could go in for human sacrifice.
Look at here, Beau, said Scanlan anxiously. I hope they keep it in the family, anyhow. We don't want them to pull no such dope on us.
No, I guess they have learned their lesson, said I. It's misfortune that teaches folk to have pity for others.
That's right, Marco remarked, poking about among the ashes. It is the old hereditary god, but it is surely a gentler cult. These are burned loaves and the like, but perhaps there was a time.
But our speculations were interrupted by a stern voice at our elbow, and we found several men in yellow garments and high hats, who were clearly the priests of the temple. From the expression on their faces, I should judge that we were very near to being the last victims of Baal, and one of them had actually drawn a knife from his girdle. With fierce gestures and cries, they drove us roughly out of their sacred shrine.
"By gosh," cried Scanlan, "I'll sock that duck if he keeps crowding me. Look at here, you bindle stiff. Keep your hands off my coat."
For a moment, I feared that we should have had what Scanlan called a rough house within the sacred precincts. However, we got the angry mechanic away without blows and regained the shelter of our room. But we could tell from the demeanor of Manda and others of our friends that our escapade was known and resented. But there was another shrine, which was freely shown to us, and which had a very unexpected result, where it opened up a slow and imperfect method of communication between our companions and ourselves. This was a room in the lower quarter of the temple, with no decorations or distinction, save that at one end there stood a statue of ivory, yellow with age, representing a woman holding a spear with an owl perched upon her shoulder. A very old man was the guardian of this room, and in spite of his age, it was clear to us that he was of a very different race, and one of a finer, larger type than the men of the temple. As we stood gazing at the ivory statue, Marco and I, both wondering where we had seen something like it, the old man addressed us.
"Thea," he said, pointing to the figure.
"By George," I cried, "he is speaking Greek."
"Thea, Athena," repeated the man. There was not a doubt about it. Goddess Athena. The words were unmistakable.
Marco, whose wonderful brain had absorbed something from every branch of human knowledge, began at once to ask questions in classical Greek, which were only partly understood, and were answered in a dialect so archaic that it was almost incomprehensible. Still, he acquired some knowledge, and he found an intermediary through whom he could dimly convey something to our companions.
"It is a remarkable proof," said Marco that evening, in his high, neighing voice, and in the tones of one addressing a large class, "of the reliability of legend. There is always a basis of fact, even if, in the course of the years, it should become distorted. You are aware, or probably are not aware, bet your life," from Scanlan, "that a war was going on between the primitive Greeks and the Atlanteans at the time of the destruction of the great island. The fact is recorded in Solon's description of what he learned from the priests of Sais. We may conjecture that there were Greek prisoners in the hands of the Atlanteans at the time, that some of them were in the service of the temple, and that they carried their own religion with them. That man was, so far as I could understand, the old hereditary priest of the cult, and perhaps when we know more we shall see something of these ancient people."
"Well, I hand it to them for good sense," said Scanlan. "I guess if you want to plaster God, it is better to have a fine woman than that blatherskite with the red eyes and the coal bunker on his knees."
"Lucky they can't understand your views," I remarked. "If they did, you might end up as a Christian martyr."
"Not so long as I can play them jazz," he answered. "I guess they've got used to me now, and they couldn't do without me." They were a cheerful crowd, and it was a happy life. But there were and are times when one's whole heart goes out to the homelands which we have lost. and visions of the dear old quadrangles of Oxford, or of the ancient elms and the familiar campus of Harvard, came up before my mind. In those early days they seemed as far from me as some landscape in the moon, and only now, in a dim, uncertain fashion, does the hope of seeing them once more begin to grow in my soul. End of section 3. Section 4 of The Marico Deep by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Thomas Copeland. 4. It was a few days after our arrival that our hosts, or our captors, we were dubious sometimes as to which to call them, took us out for an expedition upon the bottom of the ocean. 6 of them came with us, including Manda, the chief. We assembled in the same exit chamber in which we had originally been received, and we were now in a condition to examine it a little more closely. It was a very large place, at least 100 feet each way, and its low walls and ceiling were green with marine growths and dripping with moisture. A long row of pegs, with marks which I presume were numbers, ran round the whole room, and on each was hung one of the semi-transparent bells of vitrine and a pair of the shoulder batteries which ensured respiration. The floor was of flagged stone worn into concavities, the footsteps of many generations, these hollows now lying as pools of shallow water. The whole was highly illuminated by fluor tubes round the cornice. We were fastened into our vitrine coverings, and a stout, pointed staff made of some light metal was handed to each of us. Then, by signals, Manda ordered us to take a grip of a rail which ran round the room, he and his friends setting us an example. The object of this soon became evident, for as the outer door swung slowly open, the sea-water came pouring in with such force that we should have been swept from our feet but for this precaution. It rose rapidly, however, to above the level of our heads, and the pressure upon us was eased. Manda led the way to the door, and an instant afterwards we were out on the ocean bed once more, leaving the portal open behind us, ready for our return. Looking round us in the cold, flickering, spectral light which illuminates the Bathybian plain, we could see for a radius of at least 1/4 mile in every direction. What amazed us was to observe, on the very limit of what was visible, a very brilliant glow of radiance. It was towards this that our leader turned his steps, our party walking in single file behind him. It was slow going, for there was the resistance of the water, and our feet were buried deeply in the soft slush with every step. But soon we were able to see clearly what the beacon was which had attracted us. It was our own shell, our last reminder of terrestrial life, which lay tilted upon one of the cupolas of the far-flung building, with all its lights still blazing. It was still 3/4 full of water, but the imprisoned air still preserved that portion in which our electric installment lay. It was strange indeed, as we gazed into it, to see the familiar interior with our settees and instruments still in position, while several good-sized fish, like minnows in a bottle, swam round and round inside it. One after the other, our party clambered in through the open flap, Marico to rescue a book of notes which floated on the surface, Scanlon and I to pick up some personal belongings. Manda came also with one or two of his comrades, examining with the greatest interest the bathometer and thermometer with the other instruments which were attached to the wall. The latter we detached and took away with us. It may interest scientists to know that 40 degrees Fahrenheit represents the temperature at the greatest sea depth to which man has ever descended, and that it is higher, on account of the chemical decomposition of the ooze, than the upper strata of the sea. Our little expedition had, it seems, a definite object besides that of allowing us a little exercise upon the bed of the ocean. We were hunting for food. Every now and then I saw our comrades strike sharply down with their pointed sticks, impaling each time a large brown flat fish, not unlike a turbot, which was numerous, but lay so closely in the ooze that it took practiced eyes to detect it. Soon each of the little men had 2 or 3 of these dangling at their sides. Scanlon and I soon got the knack of it, and captured a couple each, But Marco walked as one in a dream, quite lost in his wonder at the ocean beauties around him, and making long and excited speeches which were lost to the ear, but visible to the eyes from the contortion of his features. Our first impression had been one of monotony, but we soon found that the great plains were broken up into varied formations by the action of the deep-sea currents which flowed like submarine rivers across them. These streams cut channels in the soft slime and exposed the beds which lay beneath. The floor of these banks consisted of the red clay which forms the base of all things on the surface of the bed of the ocean, and they were thickly studded with white objects, which I imagined to be shells, but which proved, when we examined them, to be the ear bones of whales and the teeth of sharks and other sea monsters. One of these teeth which I picked up was 15 inches long, and we could but be thankful that so fearful a monster frequented the higher levels of ocean. It belonged, according to Marco, to a giant killing grampus or orca gladiator. It recalled the observation of Mitchell Hedges that even the most terrible sharks that he had caught bore upon their bodies the marks which showed that they had encountered creatures larger and more formidable than themselves. There was one peculiarity of the ocean depths which impresses itself upon the observer. There is, as I have said, a constant cold light rising from the slow phosphorescent decay of the great masses of organic matter. But above, all is black as night. The effect is that of a dim winter day, with a heavy black thundercloud lying low above the earth. Out of this black canopy there falls slowly an incessant snowstorm of tiny white flakes, which glimmer against the somber background. These are the shells of sea snails and other small creatures who live and die in the 5 miles of water which separate us from the surface, and though many of these are dissolved as they fall and add to the lime salts in the ocean, the rest go in the course of ages to form that deposit which has entombed the great city in the upper part of which we now dwelt. Leaving our last link with earth beneath us, we pushed on into the gloom of the submarine world, and soon we were met by a completely new development. A moving patch appeared in front of us, which broke up as we approached it into a crowd of men, each in his vitrine envelope, who were dragging behind them broad sledges heaped with coal. It was heavy work, and the poor devils were bending and straining, tugging hard at the shark-skin ropes which served as traces. With each gang of men there was one who appeared to be in authority, and it interested us to see that the leaders and the workers were clearly of a different race. The latter were tall men, fair, with blue eyes and powerful bodies. The others were, as already described, dark and almost negroid, with squat, broad frames. We could not inquire into the mystery at that moment, but the impression was left upon my mind that the one race represented the hereditary slaves of the other, and Marco was of opinion that they may have been the descendants of those Greek prisoners whose goddess we had seen in the temple. Several droves of these men, each drawing its loads of coal, were met by us before we came to the mine itself. At this point, the deep-sea deposits and the sandy formations which lay beneath them had been cut away, and a great pit exposed, which consisted of alternate layers of clay and coal, representing strata in the old perished world of long ago, which now lay at the bottom of the Atlantic. At the various levels of this huge excavation, we could see gangs of men at work hewing the coal, while others gathered it into loads and placed it in baskets, by means of which it was hoisted up to the level above. The whole mine was on so vast a scale that we could not see the other side of the enormous pit which so many generations of workers had scooped in the bed of the ocean. This, then, transmuted into electric force, was the source of the motive power by which the whole machinery of Atlantis was run. It is interesting, by the way, to record that the name of the old city had been correctly preserved in the legends, for when we had mentioned it to Manda and others, they first looked greatly surprised that we should know it, and then nodded their heads vigorously to show that they understood. Passing the great coal pit, or rather branching away from it to the right, we came on a line of low cliffs of basalt, their surface as clear and shining as on the day when they were shot up from the bowels of the earth, while their summit, some hundreds of feet above us, loomed up against the dark background. The base of these volcanic cliffs was draped in a deep jungle of high seaweed, growing out of tangled masses of crinoid corals laid down in the old terrestrial days. Along the edge of this thick undergrowth we wandered for some time, our companions beating it with their sticks and driving out for our amusement an extraordinary assortment of strange fishes and crustacea, now and again securing a specimen for their own tables. For a mile or more we wandered along in this happy fashion when I saw Amanda stop suddenly and look round him with gestures of alarm and surprise. These submarine gestures formed a language in themselves, for in a moment his companions understood the cause of his trouble, and then with a shock we realized it also. Dr. Marico had disappeared. He had certainly been with us at the coal pit, and he had come as far as the basalt cliffs. It was inconceivable that he had got ahead of us, so it was evident that he must be somewhere along the line of jungle in our rear. Though our friends were disturbed, Scanlon and I, who knew something of the good man's absent-minded eccentricities, were confident that there was no cause for alarm, and that we should soon find him loitering over some sea-form which had attracted him. We all turned to retrace our steps, and had hardly gone 100 yards before we caught sight of him. But he was running with an agility which I should have thought impossible for a man of his habits. Even the least athletic can run, however, when fear is the pacemaker. His hands were outstretched for help, and he stumbled and blundered forward with clumsy energy. He had good cause to exert himself, for three horrible creatures were close at his heels. They were tiger crabs, striped black and white, each about the size of a Newfoundland dog. Fortunately, they were themselves not very swift travelers, and were scurrying along the soft sea bottom in a curious sidelong fashion, which was little faster than that of the terrified fugitive. Their wind was better, however, and they would probably have had their horrible claws upon him in a very few minutes had not our friends intervened. They dashed forward with their pointed sticks, and Manda flashed a powerful electric lantern, which he carried in his belt, in the faces of the loathsome monsters, who scuttled into the jungle and were lost to view. Our comrade sat down on a lump of coral, and his face showed that he was exhausted by his adventure. He told us afterwards that he had penetrated the jungle in the hope of securing what seemed to him to be a rare specimen of the deep-sea chimera, and that he had blundered into the nest of these fierce tiger crabs, who had instantly dashed after him. It was only after a long rest that he was able to resume the journey. Our next stage, after skirting the basalt cliffs, led us to our goal. The grey plain in front of us was covered, at this point, by irregular hummocks and tall projections, which told us that the great city of old lay beneath it. It would all have been completely buried forever by the ooze, as Herculaneum has been by lava, or Pompeii by ashes, had an entrance to it not been excavated by the survivors of the temple. This entrance was a long, downward cutting, which ended up in a broad street with buildings exposed on either side. The walls of these buildings were occasionally cracked and shattered, for they were not of the solid construction which had preserved the temple, but the interiors were in most cases exactly as they had been when the catastrophe occurred, save the sea changes of all sorts, beautiful and rare in some cases, and horrifying in others, had modified the appearances of the rooms. Our guides did not encourage us to examine the first ones we reached, but hurried us onwards until we came to that which had clearly been the great central citadel, or palace, round which the whole town centred. The pillars and columns and vast sculptured cornices and friezes and staircases of this building exceeded anything which I have ever seen upon earth. Its nearest approach seemed to me to be the remains of the Temple of Karnak at Luxor in Egypt, and, strange to say, the decorations and half-effaced engravings resembled in detail those of the great ruin beside the Nile, and the lotus-shaped capitals of the columns were the same. It was an amazing experience to stand in the marble tessellated floors of those vast halls, with great statues looming high above one on every side, and to see, as we saw that day, huge silvery eels gliding above our heads, and frightened fish darting away in every direction from the light which was projected before us. From room to room we wandered, marking every sign of luxury, and occasionally of that lascivious folly which is said by the lingering legend to have drawn God's curse upon the people. One small room was wonderfully enameled with mother-of-pearl, so that even now it gleamed with brilliant opalescent tints when the light played across it. An ornamented platform of yellow metal and a similar couch lay in one corner, and one felt that it may well have been the bedchamber of a queen. But beside the couch there lay now a loathsome black squid, its foul body rising and falling in a slow, stealthy rhythm, so that it seemed like some evil heart which still beat in the very center of the wicked palace. I was glad, and so I learned were my companions, when our guides led the way out once more, glancing for a moment at a ruined amphitheater, and again at a pier with a lighthouse at the end, which showed that the city had been a seaport. Soon we had emerged from these places of ill omen, and were out on the familiar Bathybian plain once more. Our adventures were not quite over, for there was one more which was as alarming to our companions as to ourselves. We had nearly made our way home when one of our guides pointed upwards with alarm. Gazing in that direction, we saw an extraordinary sight. Out of the black gloom of the waters, a huge dark figure was emerging, falling rapidly downwards. At first it seemed a shapeless mass, but as it came more clearly into the light, we could see that it was the dead body of a monstrous fish, which had burst so that the entrails were streaming up behind it as it fell. No doubt the gases had buoyed it up in the higher reaches of the ocean, until, having been released by putrefaction or by the ravages of sharks, there was nothing left but dead weight, which sent it hurtling down to the bottom of the sea. Already in our walk we had observed several of these great skeletons picked clean by the fish, but this creature was still, save for its disembowelment, even as it had lived. Our guide seized us, with the intention of dragging us out of the path of the falling mass, but presently they were reassured and stood still, for it was clear that it would miss us. Our vitrine helmets prevented our hearing the thud, but it must have been prodigious when that huge body struck the floor of the ocean, and we saw the Globigerina ooze fly upwards as the mud splashes when a heavy stone is hurled into it. It was a sperm whale, some 70 feet long, and from the excited and joyful gestures of the submarine folk, I gathered that they would find plenty of use for the spermaceti and the fat. For the moment, however, we left the derelict creature, and with joyful hearts, for we unpracticed visitors were weary and aching, found ourselves once more in front of the engraved portal of the roof, and finally standing, safe and sound, divested of our vitrine bells, on the sloppy floor of the entrance chamber. A few days, as we reckon time, after the occasion when we had given the community a cinema view of our own proceedings, we were present at a very much more solemn and august exhibition of the same sort, which gave us, in a clear and wonderful way, the past history of this remarkable people. I cannot flatter myself that it was given entirely on our behalf, for I rather think that the events were publicly rehearsed from time to time in order to carry on the record, and that the part to which we were admitted was only some intermezzo of a long religious ceremony. However that may be, I will describe it exactly as it occurred. We were led to the same great hall or theatre where Dr. Marico had thrown our own adventures upon the screen. There the whole community was assembled, and we were given, as before, places of honour in front of the great luminous screen. Then, after a long song, which may have been some sort of patriotic chant, a very old white-haired man, the historian or chronicler of the nation, advanced amid much applause to the focus point, and threw upon the bright surface before him a series of pictures to represent the rise and fall of his own people. I wish I could convey to you their vividness and drama. My two companions and I lost all sense of time and place, so absorbed were we in the contemplation, while the audience was moved to its depths, and groaned or wept as the tragedy unfolded, which depicted the ruin of their fatherland, the destruction of their race. In the first series of scenes, we saw the old continent in its glory, as its memory had been handed down by these historical records passed from fathers to sons. We had a bird's-eye view of a glorious rolling country, enormous in extent, well-watered and cleverly irrigated, with great fields of grain, waving orchards, lovely streams and woody hills, still lakes and occasional picturesque mountains. It was studded with villages and covered with farmhouses and beautiful private residences. Then our attention was carried to the capital, a wonderful and gorgeous city upon the seashore, the harbor crammed with galleys, her quays piled with merchandise, and her safety assured by high walls with towering battlements and circular moats, all on the most gigantic scale. The houses stretched inland for many miles, and in the center of the city was a crenellated castle or citadel, so widespread and commanding that it was like some creation of a dream. We were then shown the faces of those who lived in that golden age, wise and venerable old men, virile warriors, saintly priests, beautiful and dignified women, lovely children, an apotheosis of the human race. Then came pictures of another sort. We saw wars, constant wars, war by land and war by sea. We saw naked and defenseless races, trampled down and overridden by great chariots or the rush of mailed horsemen. We saw treasures heaped upon the victors, but even as the riches increased, the faces upon the screen became more animal and more cruel. Down, down they sank from one generation to another. We were shown signs of lascivious dissipation, or moral degeneracy, of the accretion of matter and decline of spirit. Brutal sports at the expense of others had taken the place of the manly exercises of old. There was no longer the quiet and simple family life, nor the cultivation of the mind, but we had a glimpse of a people who were restless and shallow, rushing from one pursuit to another, grasping ever at pleasure, forever missing it, and yet imagining always that in some more complex and unnatural form it might still be found. There had arisen, on the one hand, an over-rich class who sought only sensual gratification, and on the other hand, an over-poor residue whose whole function in life was to minister to the wants of their masters, however evil those wants might be. And now, once again, a new note was struck. There were reformers at work who were trying to turn the nation from its evil ways and to direct it back into those higher paths which it had forsaken. We saw them, grave and earnest men, reasoning and pleading with the people, but we saw them scorned and jeered at by those whom they were trying to save. Especially we could see that it was the priests of Baal, priests who had gradually allowed forms and show and outward ceremonies to take the place of unselfish spiritual development, who led the opposition to the reformers. But the latter were not to be bullied or browbeaten. They continued to try for the salvation of the people, and their faces assumed a graver and even a terror-inspiring aspect, as those of men who had a fearsome warning to give, which was like some dreadful vision before their own minds. Of their auditors, some few seemed to heed and be terrified at the words, but others turned away laughing and plunged ever deeper into their morass of sin. There came a time at last when the reformers turned away also, as men who could do no more, and left this degenerate people to its fate. Then we saw a strange sight. There was one reformer, a man of singular strength of mind and body, who gave a lead to all the others. He had wealth and influence and powers, which latter seemed to be not entirely of this earth. We saw him in what seemed to be a trance, communing with higher spirits. It was he who brought all the science of his land, science which far outshone anything known by us moderns, to the task of building an ark of refuge against the coming troubles. We saw myriads of workmen at work, and the walls rising, while crowds of careless citizens looked on and made merry at such elaborate and useless precautions. We saw others who seemed to reason with him, and to say to him that if he had fears it would be easier for him to fly to some safer land. His answer, so far as we could follow it, was that there were some who must be saved at the last moment, and that for their sake he must remain in the new temple of safety. Meanwhile he collected in it those who had followed him, and he held them there, for he did not himself know the day nor the hour, though forces beyond mortal had assured him of the coming fact. So, when the ark was ready and the watertight doors were finished and tested, he waited upon doom with his family, his friends, his followers, and his servants. And doom came. It was a terrible thing, even in a picture. God knows what it would be like in reality. We first saw a huge, sleek mountain of water rise to an incredible height out of a calm ocean. Then we saw it travel, sweeping on and on, mile after mile, a great glistening hill, topped with foam at an ever-increasing rate. Two little chips tossing among the snowy fringe upon the summit became, as the wave rolled towards us, a couple of shattered galleys. Then we saw it strike the shore and sweep over the city, while the houses went down before it like a field of corn before a tornado. We saw the folk upon the housetops glaring out at the approaching death, their faces twisted with horror, their eyes staring, their mouths contorted, gnawing at their hands and gibbering in an insanity of terror. The very men and women who had mocked at the warning were now screaming to heaven for mercy, groveling with their faces on the ground, or kneeling with frenzied arms raised in wild appeal. There was no time now to reach the ark, which stood beyond the city, but thousands dashed up to the citadel, which stood upon higher ground, and the battlement walls were black with people. Then, suddenly, the castle began to sink. Everything began to sink. The water had poured down into the remote recesses of the earth, the central fires had expanded it into steam, and the very foundations of the land were blown apart. Down went the city, and ever down, while a cry went up from ourselves and the audience at the terrible sight. The pier broke in two and vanished. The high pharos collapsed under the waves. The roofs looked for a while like successive reefs of rock, forming lines of spouting breakers, until they too went under. The citadel was left alone upon the surface, like some monstrous ship, and then it also slid sideways down into the abyss, with a fringe of helpless waving hands upon its summit. The awful drama was over, and an unbroken sea lay across the whole continent, a sea which bore no life upon it, but which, among its huge smoking swirls and eddies, showed all the wrack of the tragedy tossed hither and thither, dead men and animals, chairs, tables, articles of clothing, floating hats and bales of goods, all bobbing and heaving in one huge liquid fermentation. Slowly we saw it die away, and a great wide expanse, as smooth and bright as quicksilver, with a murky sun low on the horizon, showed us the grave of the land that God had weighed and found wanting. The story was complete. We could ask for no more, since our own brains and imagination could supply the rest. We realized the slow, remorseless descent of that great land, lower and lower into the abyss of the ocean, amid volcanic convulsions which threw up submarine peaks around it. We saw it in our mind's eye, stretched out over miles of what was now the bed of the Atlantic, the shattered city lying alongside of the Ark of Refuge in which the handful of nerve-shattered survivors were assembled. And then, finally, we understood how these had carried on their lives, how they had used the various devices with which the foresight and science of their great leader had endowed them, how he had taught them all his arts before he passed away, and how some 50 or 60 survivors had grown now into a large community which had to dig its way into the bowels of the earth in order to get room to expand. No library of information could make it clearer than that series of pictures and the inferences which we could draw from them. Such was the fate, and such the causes of the fate, which overwhelmed the great land of Atlantis. Some day, far distant, when this Bathybian ooze has turned to chalk, this great city will be thrown up once more by some fresh exploration of nature, and the geologist of the future, delving in the quarry, will exhume not flints nor shells, but the remains of a vanished civilization and the traces of an old-world catastrophe. Only one point had remained undecided, and that was the length of time since the tragedy had occurred. Dr. Marico discovered a rough method of making an estimate. Among the many annexes of the great building, there was one huge vault which was the burial place of the chiefs. As in Egypt and in Yucatan, the practice of mummifying had been usual, and in niches in the walls there were endless rows of these grim relics of the past. Manda pointed proudly to the next one in the succession, and gave us to understand that it was specially arranged for himself. "If you take an average of the European kings," said Marico, in his best professorial manner, "you will find that they run to about 5 in the century. We may adopt the same figure here. We cannot hope for scientific accuracy, but it will give us an approximation. I have counted the mummies, and they are 400 in number." "Then it would be 8,000 years?" "Exactly. And this agrees to some extent with Plato's estimate. It certainly occurred before the Egyptian records begin, and they go back between 6,000 and 7,000 years from the present date. Yes, I think we may say that our eyes have seen the reproduction of a tragedy which occurred at least 8,000 years ago. But, of course, to build up such a civilization as we see the traces of must in itself have taken many thousands of years. Thus," he concluded, "and I pass the claim on to you, we have extended the horizon of ascertained human history as no men have ever done since history began." End of section 4. Section 5 of The Marico Deep by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Thomas Copeland. 5. It was about a month, according to our calculations, after our visit to the buried city, that the most amazing and unexpected thing of all occurred. We had thought by this time that we were immune to shocks, and that nothing new could really stagger us, but this actual fact went far beyond anything for which our imagination might have prepared us. It was Scanlan who brought the news that something momentous had happened. You must realize that by this time we were to some extent at home in the great building, that we knew where the common restrooms and recreation rooms were situated, that we attended concerts. Their music was very strange and elaborate, and theatrical entertainments, where the unintelligible words were translated by very vivid and dramatic gestures, and that, generally speaking, we were part of the community. We visited various families in their own private rooms, and our lives, I can speak for my own at any rate, were made the brighter by the glamour of these strange people, especially of that one dear young lady whose name I have already mentioned. Mona was the daughter of one of the leaders of the tribe, and I found in his family a warm and kindly welcome which rose above all differences of race or language. When it comes to the most tender language of all, I did not find that there was so much between old Atlantis and modern America. I guess that what would please the Massachusetts girl of Brown's College is just about what would please my lady under the waves. But I must get back to the fact that Scanlan came into our room with news of some great happening. "Say, there is one of them just blown in, and he's that excited that he clean forgot to take his glass lid off, and he was jabbering for some minutes before he understood that no one could hear him. Then it was blah, blah, blah as long as his breath would hold, and they are all following him now to the jumping-off place. It's me for the water, for there's sure something worth our seeing." Running out, we found our friends all hurrying down the corridor with excited gestures, and we, joining the procession, soon formed part of the crowd who were hurrying across the sea bottom, led by the excited messenger. They drove along at a rate which made it no easy matter for us to keep up, but they carried their electric lanterns with them, and even though we fell behind, we were able to follow the gleam. The route lay as before along the base of the basalt cliffs until we came to a spot where a set of steps, concave from long usage, led up to the top. Ascending these, we found ourselves in broken country, with many jagged pinnacles of rock and deep crevasses, which made it difficult travelling. Emerging from this tangle of ancient lava, we came out on a circular plain, brilliant in the phosphorescent light, and there, in the very centre of it, lay an object which set me gasping. As I looked at my companions, I could see from their amazed expression how fully they shared my emotion. Half embedded in the slime, there lay a good-sized steamer. It was tilted upon its side. The funnel had broken and was hanging at a strange angle, and the foremast had snapped short off, but otherwise the vessel was intact and as clean and fresh as if she had just left the dock. We hurried towards her and found ourselves under the stern. You can imagine how we felt when we read the name Stratford, London. Our ship had followed ourselves into the Marigold Deep. Of course, after the first shock, the affair did not seem so incomprehensible. We remembered the falling glass, the reefed sails of the experienced Norwegian skipper, the strange black cloud upon the horizon. Clearly there had been a sudden cyclone of phenomenal severity, and the Stratford had been blown over. It was too evident that all her people were dead, for most of the boats were trailing in different states of destruction from the davits, and in any case, what boat could live in such a hurricane? The tragedy had occurred, no doubt, within an hour or two of our own disaster. Perhaps the sounding line, which we had seen, had only just been wound in before the blow fell. It was terrible, but whimsical, that we should be still alive, while those who were mourning our destruction had themselves been destroyed. We had no means of telling whether the ship had drifted in the upper levels of the ocean, or whether she had lain for some time where we found her before she was discovered by the Atlantean. Poor Howie, the captain, or what was left of him, was still at his post upon the bridge, the rail grasped firmly in his stiffened hands. His body and that of three stokers in the engine room were the only ones which had sunk with the ship. They were each removed, under our direction, and buried under the ooze, with a wreath of sea flowers over their remains. I give this detail in the hope that it may be some comfort to Mrs. Howie in her bereavement. The names of the stokers were unknown to us. Whilst we had been performing this duty, the little men had swarmed over the ship. Looking up, we saw them everywhere like mice upon a cheese. Their excitement and curiosity made it clear to us that it was the first modern ship, possibly the first steamer, which had ever come down to them. We found out later that their oxygen apparatus inside their vitrine bells would not allow of a longer absence from the recharging station than a few hours, and so their chances of learning anything of what was on the seabed were limited to so many miles from their central base. They set to work at once, breaking up the wreck and removing all that would be of use to them, a very long process which is hardly accomplished yet. We were glad also to make our way to our cabins and to get many of those articles of clothing and books which were not ruined beyond redemption. Among the other things which we rescued from the Stratford was the ship's log, which had been written up to the last day by the captain in view of our own catastrophe. It was strange indeed that we should be reading it, and that he should be dead. The day's entry ran thus. October 3rd. The three brave but foolhardy adventurers have today, against my will and advice, descended in their apparatus to the bottom of the ocean, and the accident which I had foreseen has occurred. God rest their souls. They went down at 11 a.m., and I had some doubts about permitting them, as a squall seemed to be coming up. I would that I had acted upon my impulse, but it would only have postponed the inevitable tragedy. I bade each of them farewell with the conviction that I would see them no more. For a time all was well, and at 11:45 they had reached a depth of 300 fathoms, where they had found bottom. Dr. Marigot sent several messages to me, and all seemed to be in order, when suddenly I heard his voice in agitation, and there was considerable agitation of the wire hawser. An instant later it snapped. It would appear that they were by this time over a deep chasm, for at the doctor's request the ship had steamed very slowly forwards. The air tubes continued to run out for a distance which I should estimate at half a mile, and then they also snapped. It is the last which we can ever hope to hear of Dr. Marigot, Mr. Headley, and Mr. Scanlon. And yet a most extraordinary thing must be recorded, the meaning of which I have not had time to weigh, for with this foul weather coming up there is much to distract me. A deep-sea sounding was taken at the same time, and the depth recorded was 26,600 feet. The weight was, of course, left at the bottom, but the wire has just been drawn in, and, incredible as it may seem, above the porcelain sample cup there was found Mr. Headley's handkerchief, with his name marked upon it. The ship's company are all amazed, and no one can suggest how such a thing could have occurred. In my next entry, I may have more to say about this. We have lingered a few hours in the hope of something coming to the surface, and we have pulled up the hawser, which shows a jagged end. Now I must look to the ship, for I have never seen a worse sky, and the barometer is at 28.5 and sinking fast. So it was that we got the final news of our former companions. A terrific cyclone must have struck her and destroyed her immediately afterwards. We stayed at the wreck until a certain stuffiness within our vitrine bells and a feeling of increasing weight upon our chests warned us that it was high time to begin our return. Then it was on our homeward journey that we had an adventure which showed us the sudden dangers to which these submarine folk are exposed, and which may explain why their numbers, in spite of the lapse of time, were not greater than they were. Including the Grecian slaves, we cannot reckon those numbers at more than 4,000 or 5,000 at the most. We had descended the staircase, and were making our way along the edge of the jungle which skirts the basalt cliffs, when Manda pointed excitedly upwards and beckoned furiously to one of our party who was some distance out in the open. At the same time, he and those around him ran to the side of some high boulders, pulling us along with them. It was only when we were in the shelter that we saw the cause of the alarm. Some distance above us, but descending rapidly, was a huge fish of a most peculiar shape. It might have been a great floating feather bed, soft and bulging, with a white undersurface and a long red fringe, the vibration of which propelled it through the water. It appeared to have neither mouth nor eyes, but it soon showed that it was formidably alert. The member of our party who was out in the open ran for the same shelter that we had taken, but he was too late. I saw his face convulsed with terror as he realized his fate. The horrible creature descended upon him, enveloped him on all sides, and lay upon him, pulsing in a dreadful way, as if it were thrusting his body against the coral rocks and grinding it to pieces. The tragedy was taking place within a few yards of us, and yet our companions were so overcome by the suddenness of it that they seemed to be bereft of all power of action. It was Scanlan who rushed out, and, jumping on the creature's broad back, blotched with red and brown markings, dug the sharp end of his metal staff into its soft tissues. I had followed Scanlan's example, and finally Marco and all of them attacked the monster, which glided slowly off, leaving a trail of oily and glutinous excretion behind it. Our help had come too late, however, for the impact of the great fish had broken the vitrine bell of the Atlantean, and he had been drowned. It was a day of mourning when we carried his body back into the refuge, but it was also a day of triumph for us, for our prompt action had raised us greatly in the estimation of our companions. As to the strange fish, we had Dr. Marico's assurance that it was a specimen of the blanket fish, well known to ichthyologists, but of a size such as had never entered into his dreams. I speak of this creature because it chanced to bring about a tragedy, but I could, and perhaps will, write a book upon the wonderful life which we have seen here. Red and black are the prevailing colors in deep-sea life, while the vegetation is of the palest olive, and is of so tough a fiber that it is seldom dragged up by our trawls, so that science has come to believe that the bed of the ocean is bare. Many of the marine forms are of surpassing loveliness, and others so grotesque in their horror that they are like the images of delirium, and of a danger such as no land animal can rival. I have seen a black stingray 30 feet long, with a horrible fang upon its tail, one blow of which would kill any living creature. I have seen, too, a frog-like beast with protruding green eyes, which is simply a gaping mouth with a huge stomach behind it. To meet it is death, unless one has an electric flash with which to repel it. I have seen the blind red eel which lies among the rocks and kills by the emission of poison, and I have seen also the giant sea scorpion, one of the terrors of the deep, and the hagfish, which lurks among the sea jungle. Once, too, it was my privilege to see the real sea-serpent, a creature which has seldom appeared before the human eye, for it lives in the extreme depths and is seen on the surface only when some submarine convulsion has driven it out of its haunts. Two of them swam, or rather glided, past us one day while Mona and I cowered among the bunches of lamellaria. They were enormous, some 10 feet in height and 200 in length, black above, silver-white below, with a high fringe upon the back, and small eyes no larger than those of an ox. Of these and many other such things an account will be found in the papers of Dr. Maricot, should it ever reach your hands. Week glided into week of our new life. It had become a very pleasant one, and we were slowly picking up enough of this long-forgotten tongue to enable us to converse a little with our companions. There were endless subjects both for study and for amusement in the refuge, and already Maricot has mastered so much of the old chemistry that he declares that he can revolutionize all worldly ideas if he can only transmit his knowledge. Among other things, they have learned to split the atom, and though the energy released is less than our scientists had anticipated, it is still sufficient to supply them with a great reservoir of power. Their acquaintance with the power and nature of the ether is also far ahead of ours, and indeed that strange translation of thought into pictures by which we had told them our story and they theirs was due to an etheric impression translated back into terms of matter. And yet, in spite of their knowledge, there were points connected with modern scientific developments which had been overlooked by their ancestors. It was left to Scanlan to demonstrate the fact. For weeks he was in a state of suppressed excitement, bursting with some great secret, and chuckling continually at his own thoughts. We only saw him occasionally during this time, for he was extremely busy, and his one friend and confidant was a fat and jovial Atlantean named Berbrix, who was in charge of some of the machinery. Scanlan and Berbrix, though their intercourse was carried on chiefly by signs and mutual backslapping, had become very close friends, and were now continually closeted together. One evening Scanlan came in radiant. "Look here, Doc," he said to Maricot. "I've a dope of my own that I want to hand to these folk. They've shown us a thing or two, and I figure that it's up to us to return it. What's the matter with calling them together tomorrow night for a show?" "Jazz or the Charleston?" I asked. "Charleston, nothing. Wait till you see it. Man, it's the greatest stunt. But there, I won't say a word more. Just this, Bo. I won't let you down, for I've got the goods, and I mean to deliver them." Accordingly, the community were assembled next evening in the familiar hall. Scanlan and Berbrix were on the platform, beaming with pride. One or other of them touched a button, and then, well, to use Scanlan's own language, "I hand it to him, for he did surprise us some." "To LO calling," cried a clear voice. "London calling the British Isles. Weather forecast." Then followed the usual sentence about depressions and anticyclones. "First news bulletin. His Majesty the King this morning opened the new wing of the Children's Hospital in Hammersmith," and so on, in the familiar strain. For the first time we were back in a workaday England once more, plodding bravely through its daily task, with its stout back bowed under its war debts. Then we heard the foreign news, the sporting news. The old world was droning on the same as ever. Our friends the Atlanteans listened in amazement, but without comprehension. When, however, as the first item after the news, the guards' band struck up the march from Lohengrin, a positive shout of delight broke from the people, and it was funny to see them rush upon the platform and turn over the curtains and look behind the screens to find the source of the music. Yes, we have left our mark forever upon the submarine civilization. "No, sir," said Scanlan afterwards. "I could not make an issuing station. They have not the material, and I have not the brains. But down at home I rigged a two-valve set of my own with the aerial beside the clothesline in the yard, and I learned to handle it and to pick up any station in the States. It seemed to me funny if, with all this electricity to hand, and with their glasswork ahead of ours, we couldn't vamp up something that would catch an ether wave, and a wave would surely travel through water just as easy as through air." Old Berbrix nearly threw a fit when we got the first call. But he is wise to it now, and I guess it's a permanent institution. Among the discoveries of the Atlantean chemists is a gas which is 9 times lighter than hydrogen, and which Marechaux has named levigen. It was his experiments with this which gave us the idea of sending glass balls with information as to our fate to the surface of the ocean. "I have made Manda understand the idea," said he. "He has given orders to the silica workers, and in a day or two the globes will be ready." "But how can we get our news inside?" I asked. "There is a small aperture left through which the gas is inserted. Into this we can push the papers. Then these skillful workers can seal up the hole. I am assured that when we release them, they will shoot up to the surface." "And bob about unseen for a year?" "That might be, but the ball would reflect the sun's rays. It would surely attract attention. We were on the line of shipping between Europe and South America. I see no reason why, if we send several, one at least may not be found. And this, my dear Talbot, or you others who read this narrative, is how it comes into your hands. But a far more fateful scheme may lie behind it. The idea came from the fertile brain of the American mechanic. Say, friends," said he, as we sat alone in our chamber, "it's dandy down here, and the drink is good, and the eats are good, and I've met a wren that makes anything in Philadelphia look like 2 cents. But all the same, there are times when I want to feel that I might see God's own country once more." "We may all feel that way," said I, "but I don't see how you can hope to make it. Look at here, Beau. If these balls of gas could carry up our message, maybe they could carry us up also. Don't think I'm joshing, for I've figured it out to rights. We will suppose we put 3 or 4 of them together so as to get a good lift, see? Then we have our vitrine bells on and harness ourselves onto the balls. When the bell rings, we cut loose and up we go. What is going to stop us between here and the surface? A shark, maybe?" "Blah, shark's nothing. We would streak past any shark, so he'd hardly know we was there. He'd think we was 3 flashes of light, and we'd get such a lick on that, we'd shoot 50 feet up in the air at the other end. I tell you, the goof that sees us come up is going to say his prayers over it. But suppose it is possible, what will happen afterwards?" "For Pete's sake, leave afterwards out of it. Let us chance our luck, or we are here for keeps. It's me for cutting loose and having a dash at it. I certainly greatly desire to return to the world, if only to lay our results before the learned societies," said Marechaux. "It is only my personal influence which can make them realize the fund of new knowledge which I have acquired. I should be quite in favor of any such attempt as Scanlon has indicated. There were good reasons, as I will tell later, which made me the least eager of the three. It would be perfect madness, as you propose it. Unless we had someone expecting us on the surface, we should infallibly drift about and perish from hunger and thirst." "Shucks, man! How could we have someone expecting us?" "Perhaps even that could be managed," said Marechaux. "We can give within a mile or two the exact latitude and longitude of our position." "And they would let down a ladder," said I, with some bitterness. "Ladder nothing! The boss is right. See here, Mr. Headley, you put in that letter that you are going to send the universe, my, don't I see the scare lines in the journals, that we are at 27 north latitude and 28.14 west latitude, or whatever other figure is the right one. Got that? Then you say that 3 of the most important folk in history, the great man of science, Marechaux, and the rising star bug collector Headley, and Bob Scanlon, a peach of a mechanic and the pride of Merrybanks, are all yellin' and whoopin' for help from the bottom of the sea. Follow my idea?" "Well, what then?" "Well, then it's up to them, you see. It's kind of a challenge that they can't forget. Same as I've read of Stanley finding Livingstone and the like. It's for them to find some way to yank us out, or to catch us at the other end if we take the jump ourselves." "We could suggest the way ourselves," said the professor. "Let them drop a deep-sea line into these waters, and we will look out for it. When it comes, we can tie a message to it and bid them stand by for us."
"You've said a mouthful," cried Bob Scanlon. "That is sure the way to do it."
"And if any lady cared to share our fortunes, four would be as easy as three," said Marigot, with a roguish smile at me.
"For that matter, five is as easy as four," said Scanlon. "But you've got it now, Mr. Headley. You write that down, and in 6 months we shall be back in London River once more.
So now we launch our two balls into that water which is to us what the air is to you. Our two little balloons will go aloft. We'll both be lost on the way. It is possible. Or may we hope that one will get through? We leave it on the knees of the gods. If nothing can be done for us, then let those who care for us know that, in any case, we are safe and happy. If, on the other hand, this suggestion could be carried out, and the money and energy for our rescue should be forthcoming, we have given you the means by which it can be done. Meanwhile, goodbye. Or is it au revoir?" So ended the narrative in the vitrine ball. The preceding narrative covers the facts so far as they were available when the account was first drawn up. While the script was in the hands of the printer, there came an epilogue of the most unexpected and sensational description. I refer to the rescue of the adventurers by Mr. Favager's steam yacht Marion, and the account sent out by the wireless transmitter of that vessel, and picked up by the cable station at the Cape de Verde Islands, which has just forwarded it to Europe and America. This account was drawn up by Mr. Key Osborne, the well-known representative of the Associated Press. It would appear that immediately upon the first narrative of the plight of Dr. Marigot and his friends reaching Europe, an expedition was quietly and effectively fitted up in the hope of bringing about a rescue. Mr. Favager generously placed his famous steam yacht at the disposal of the party, which he accompanied in person. The Marion sailed from Cherbourg in June, picked up Mr. Key Osborne and a motion picture operator at Southampton, and set forth at once for the tract of ocean which was indicated in the original document. This was reached upon the 1st of July. A deep-sea piano wire line was lowered and was dragged slowly along the bottom of the ocean. At the end of this line, beside the heavy lead, there was suspended a bottle containing a message. The message ran, "Your account has been received by the world, and we are here to help you. We duplicate this message by our wireless transmitter in the hope that it may reach you. We will slowly traverse your region. When you have detached this bottle, please replace your own message in it. We will act upon your instructions." For 2 days the Marion cruised slowly to and fro without result. On the third, a very great surprise awaited the rescue party. A small, highly luminous ball shot out of the water a few hundred yards from the ship, and proved to be a vitreous message-bearer of the sort which had been described in the original document. Having been broken with some difficulty, the following message was read. "Thanks, dear friends. We greatly appreciate your grand loyalty and energy. We receive your wireless messages with facility and are in a position to answer you in this fashion. We have endeavored to get possession of your line, but the currents lift it high and it sweeps along rather faster than even the most active of us can move against the resistance of the water. We propose to make our venture at 6 tomorrow morning, which should, according to our reckoning, be Tuesday, July 5th. We will come one at a time, so that any advice arising from our experience can be wirelessed back to those who come later. Once again, heartfelt thanks. Marigot, Headley, Scanlon." Mr. Key Osborne now takes up the narrative. "It was a perfect morning, and the deep sapphire sea lay as smooth as a lake, with the glorious arch of the deep blue sky unbroken by the smallest cloud. The whole crew of the Marion was early astir, and awaited events with the most tense interest. As the hour of 6 drew near, our anticipation was painful. A lookout had been placed upon our signal mast, and it was just 5 minutes to the hour when we heard him shouting, and saw him pointing to the water on our port bow. We all crowded to that side of the deck, and I was able to perch myself on one of the boats from which I had a clear view. I saw through the still water something which looked like a silver bubble ascending with great rapidity from the depths of the ocean. It broke the surface about 200 yards from the ship, and soared straight up into the air, a beautiful shining globe some 3 feet in diameter, rising to a great height, and then drifting away in some slight current of wind, exactly as a toy balloon would do. It was a marvelous sight, but it filled us with apprehension, for it seemed as if the harness might have come loose, and the burden which this tractor should have borne through the waters had been shaken loose upon the way. A wireless was at once dispatched. "Your messenger has appeared close to the vessel. It had nothing attached and has flown away." Meanwhile, we lowered a boat so as to be ready for any development. Just after 6 o'clock, there was another signal from our watchman, and an instant later I caught sight of another silver globe, which was swimming up from the depths very much more slowly than the last. On reaching the surface, it floated in the air, but its burden was supported upon the water. This burden proved upon examination to be a great bundle of books, papers, and miscellaneous objects all wrapped in a casing of fish skin. It was hoisted dripping upon the deck, and was acknowledged by wireless, while we eagerly awaited the next arrival. This was not long in coming. Again the silver bubble, again the breaking of the surface, but this time the glistening ball shot high into the air, suspending under it, to our amazement, the slim figure of a woman. It was but the impetus which had carried her into the air, and an instant later she had been towed to the side of the vessel. A leather circlet had been firmly fastened round the upper curve of the glass ball, and from this long straps depended, which were attached to a broad leather belt round her dainty waist. The upper part of her body was covered by a peculiar pear-shaped glass shade. I call it glass, but it was of the same tough, light material as the vitreous ball. It was almost transparent, with silvery veins running through its substance. This glass covering had tight elastic attachments at the waist and shoulders, which made it perfectly watertight, while it was provided within, as has been described in Headley's original manuscript, with novel but very light and practical chemical apparatus for the renovation of air. With some difficulty, the breathing bell was removed, and the lady hoisted upon deck. She lay there in a deep faint, but her regular breathing encouraged us to think that she would soon recover from the effects of her rapid journey, and from the change of pressure, which had been minimized by the fact that the density of the air inside the protective sheath was considerably higher than our atmosphere, so that it may be said to have represented that halfway point at which human divers are wont to pause. Presumably this is the Atlantean woman referred to in the first message as Mona. And if we may take her as a sample, they are indeed a race worth reintroducing to Earth. She is dark in complexion, beautifully clear-cut and high-bred in feature, with long black hair and magnificent hazel eyes, which looked round her presently in a charming amazement. Seashells and mother-of-pearl were worked into her cream-colored tunic, and tangled in her dark hair. A more perfect naiad of the deep could not be imagined, the very personification of the mystery and the glamour of the sea. We could see complete consciousness coming back into those marvelous eyes, and then she sprang suddenly to her feet with the activity of a young doe, and ran to the side of the vessel. "Cyrus! Cyrus!" she cried. We had already removed the anxiety of those below by a wireless, but now, in quick succession, each of them arrived, shooting 30 or 40 feet into the air, and then falling back into the sea, from which we quickly raised them. All three were unconscious, and Scanlan was bleeding at the nose and ears, but within an hour all were able to totter to their feet. The first action of each was, I imagine, characteristic. Scanlan was led off by a lapping group to the bar, from which shouts of merriment are now resounding, much to the detriment of this composition. Dr. Maricot seized the bundle of papers, tore out one which consisted entirely, so far as I could judge, of algebraic symbols, and disappeared downstairs, while Cyrus Headley ran to the side of his strange maiden, and looks, by last reports, as if he had no intention of ever quitting it. Thus the matter stands, and we trust our weak wireless will carry our message as far as the Cape de Verde station. The fuller details of this wonderful adventure will come later, as is fitting, from the adventurers themselves. End of section 5.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 16th through the 26th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your bedroom, living room, or home office, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.